Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of July. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about something that many aren't recognizing because we have an image of where poor people in this country live. And we think about cities or we think about rural areas of the country. But astoundingly, nearly one third of all Americans are poor or nearly poor. And one in three of those Americans happen to be living in the suburbs. Our guest this hour is the co-author of Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. And even our guest, who knows a great deal about poverty in this country, got to the issue of suburban poverty really by accident. We will find out how that happened in just one moment. But we'll be looking at all the decades of growth and change in suburbs, coupled with long-term economic restructuring and also the deep U.S. economic downturn, which has resulted in more Americans living below the poverty line in suburbs than in the nation's big cities, which is fairly remarkable. Our guest this hour is Alan Berube. He is Senior Fellow and Deputy Director at the Brookings Institution Metropolitan Policy Program and co-author of Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. He's written extensively on metropolitan demographic and economic trends, social policies affecting low-income families and communities and cities in the global economy. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Alan, and here is how you reach us by phone, 800-486-8655, by email, talk at WPR.org, by Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Alan, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's pleasure to be with you.
It is remarkable, and it's interesting that you, of all people, who's been studying low-income people and poverty in the country, until you really analyze this, who knew that poor people live in the huge numbers that they do in the suburbs of this country? We think about everybody being pretty well off. Ain't necessarily so, is it?
Yeah, we didn't know it ourselves. And, you know, like most Americans my age, which is approaching middle age, I grew up in the suburbs, too. I grew up in the suburbs of Worcester, Massachusetts. It's a older industrial city in the central part of the state. And, you know, I just thought about the place where I grew up as sort of middle America, you know, at the time mostly white. People lived in single family homes and we went to, you know, same schools. I think back on that experience now, which was, you know, 25, 30 years ago. And, I say, oh, you know what? There were some people I went to school with who were struggling to get by. And now I go back to my town, and it's a much more diverse place than it used to be. And there are more families in parts of the town that have been a little bit left behind in the new economy. So I think it was sort of always there in suburbia, but the changes in suburbia over the last, you know, 20 or 30 years have made poverty more a feature of the suburban landscape. It hasn't gone away in cities, but in a way, suburbs are what, more and more, they're just what America is and the American economy is. And to the extent that poverty is more and more a structural feature of the American economy, I guess it shouldn't be a surprise that we find it in suburbs in greater and greater numbers.
And when you look at the past, I think about, I grew up in a suburban area too, in the city for a while, and then moving out of the city as a lot of people did. And what I would add to that is mom stayed home, dad took the train, the Chicago Northwestern, into the city, which allowed her to have some of the teachers over to serve lunch so we could get better grades, you know. I mean, it was a kind of growing up that just is hard to imagine these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the kids that those teachers would be teaching today, I think probably, you know, look a lot different than the kids, you know, back then. They probably have more complicated home environments, new types of issues. And it's not to say that, you know, suburban teachers or principals or schools aren't capable of dealing with the issues that poverty brings. It's just that I don't think they've been at it for as long. I don't think they were maybe prepared in the same way that their city counterparts were. And I think the public policy is sort of, you know, maybe not intentionally, but just ignored what the growth of poverty in these new communities was going to mean for the people and the institutions in those places.
You start with a drive about 45 miles east of San Francisco in the community you describe. There are lots of different communities, but you could say that a lot of communities throughout this country that are suffering from suburban poverty may be typified in 45 miles east of San Francisco. What's going on there?
Yeah, this is a really, you know, interesting story that we uncovered in some of the field work that we did while researching this book. And we chose to start the book with a story about these communities east of San Francisco and Oakland, and they're in the eastern part of Contra Costa County, California, so sort of midway between the Bay Area and Sacramento. We chose to begin it there because if you look at this community of Antioch, Brentwood, Pittsburgh, the names of these places in inland California, they look like the quintessential American suburb. And in a lot of ways, that's why they grew so fast over the last 10 years, is the limited supply of affordable middle-class housing, you know, in and around the cities of San Francisco and Oakland had a lot of families doing what some call driving to qualify. So driving farther and farther out in the metropolitan area until they reach a community where they can qualify for a mortgage on a single-family home with, you know, three bedrooms, two bathrooms. Many of them had pools. Some of them were in sort of gated communities. So the very essence of what a aspirational middle class community is in America today, and has been, I think, for a long time. But what this community was built on was really the housing market. And as they built more and more housing over the late 90s and early 2000s, more and more of the economy got based on construction and financing housing construction, landscaping, selling you things that you could put in your house. And there wasn't, beyond that, not much of an economy built in these communities. When the housing market fell apart in 2007 and 2008, the bottom literally fell out of these communities. And the people who had moved out there, in a lot of cases from the cities of San Francisco and Oakland for those affordable opportunities, they lost jobs, they lost earners and incomes, they fell below the poverty line. People who had invested in properties there, hoping to hold on to it and then flip it for a profit, decided that wasn't going to happen, so they rented out to low-income people who were looking for an affordable housing opportunity. And almost overnight, poverty became a much more central feature of those communities than it ever had been, without any of the kinds of institutions or capacity or expertise to help low-income families and communities that you know, the cities of San Francisco and Oakland have built up over a long, long time.
And Alan, tell me about the jobs these people used to have. They would commute to San Francisco or to Oakland for what kind of work? Was it a commuting situation?
Yeah, I mean, they were very much the kind of bedroom communities that, you know, many suburbs start off as. They're, as you mentioned, about 45 miles east of the core of the Bay Area. And so a lot of folks who, you know, who were employed were driving back in every day, hour to an hour and a half each way, into Oakland and San Francisco and those environs. You know, working at public sector jobs, many of them, working in service industries, you know, clearing, working to middle class income, and maybe it was one parent, or maybe it was both parents. That was sort of one type of worker, and then the other types of workers were those that were employed in the construction industry and related sort of housing industries in and around those communities. And so both of those types of, you know, workers from both of those types of sectors took a big hit during the recession. And so what it were at one time a lot of sort of stable, you know, middle-class or aspirational middle-class households found themselves in very difficult economic circumstances and at a far, far remove from from the sorts of services and connections mm-hmm. that their more urban counterparts might be able to take for granted.
Because they haven't been put in place. The infrastructure isn't there. We didn't think there would be poverty in the suburbs, huh?
Yeah, there's no community development to speak of in eastern Contra Costa County, right. California. That's something for the folks in Oakland and Richmond and, you know, inner Alameda County, where they've had poor communities for a long, long time, starting in the 50s and the 60s. Not a feature of these communities. And I think even as the problems began to surface there and in a lot of the suburban communities we visited, there was a resistance and a reluctance to recognize them, because the minute you recognize them, then you have to start to do something about them, and that right. takes resources and political will.
And is there something unique about what was happening with poverty in Contra Costa country, or can you duplicate that story in suburban areas that are also facing poverty all over the country?
Yeah, I mean, we visited metropolitan area after metropolitan area, and all of them were experiencing this issue of rapidly suburbanizing poverty in one way or another. It was a different set of underlying factors in different places. So, for instance, when we went to south of Seattle in King County, Washington, immigration and the arrival of new refugee populations was more of the story. If you look at the Washington, D.C. area, gentrification and the loss of affordable housing in the city and the growth of affordable housing in suburban communities is a bigger part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
West of Cleveland, the decline of the manufacturing industry is the big driver. So I think there are a lot of different factors that combine in different ways in different places, but the net result in each and every single U.S. metropolitan area that we looked at closely was this shift of where the poor population was, not necessarily out of cities, but definitely in a relative way, much faster growth in suburban communities.
What amazed you and what amazes me, even now when I read it for the third time today, one-third of all Americans poor or nearly poor, one in three living in the suburbs. And who would have thought that? That's still a remarkable thing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we talk a little bit about this in the book, but I think it's not just the transformation of poverty and the location of poverty, but it's also the transformation of suburbia. And what suburbia was 30 or 40
right.
years ago is not what it is today. And there are just suburbia is this kind of catch-all phrase, and really it envelops a very wide range of communities from, you know, what today I think in a lot of, you know, outside of Milwaukee and Madison and other places in the Midwest are, you know, the same. They look and feel like the suburbs that, you know, I and others grew up in 30 or 40 years ago. Bedroom communities, kind of homogeneous in their demographic and their economic makeup. But a lot of suburbs now are former industrial towns with a housing stock to match. Many were built in the 40s and the 50s, and they have housing that isn't what the middle class wants today, and so it's affordable to lower-income households. A lot of these places were always more diverse in their social and economic makeup than we typically think of when we think of suburbia. So it's not just where poor people have moved to. It is the transformation of a notion of Americana and what suburbs are. So that in a way, it's really helping to diminish these historical differences between cities and suburbs across a whole array of different dimensions.
Ellen writes early in the book that he and the co-author met with thoughtful, highly innovative individuals and organizations who are inventing a different kind of future for suburbia and trying to address the issue of poverty, and they want to give their efforts the prominence they so richly deserve. One of the reasons, and it's good to hear about solutions too. We can get mired in things are really bad, but there are people who are giving their all in some innovative ways. So we'll hear about some of those in a moment. Our guest is the co-author of Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. Alan Barubi is with us. Alan is a senior fellow and deputy director at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, and traveled all over the country to look at suburban poverty. Here's how you reach our conversation, and we'd like very much to hear from you. We have spent a lot of time the last couple of weeks talking about people who have lost their jobs and are trying to fashion lives based on wages that just are hard to keep you going, and obviously that affects people in suburban areas, although we tend to think of people in cities. But suburban areas not having the infrastructure in place to deal with poverty in terms of services that are available that may be more concentrated in the city, in terms of transportation issues, all kinds of issues, housing problems too, immigration populations moving in, and second language concerns. There are a whole host of issues here. So what were the innovative solutions they found as they traveled the country? Join the conversation, please. 800-486-8655. That is, if you have something to say. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, and that's The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with a co-author of Confronting Suburban Poverty in America, Alan Berube, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we start our calls with Daniel in Ashland. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there.
Hi, go ahead, sir.
Yes, I've been listening for over an hour with the previous show with food stamps and now with this program on about American poverty. And I just, as I mentioned to your call screener, you know, back when I grew up, my parents, my mom stayed home. My dad worked very, very hard. He only had a high school education. But that was a different time in the 60s and 70s and 80s where, I mean, one person could work and get by and have a pretty good life and upgrade as you went through life. But today, the American dream has been taken. I think there's so much greed, top corporations and politics. I don't believe in our politicians anymore. It's very, very frustrating, and it breaks my heart. Where's the compassion and loving one another and helping one another? And I don't have any answers, but I just wanted to make those comments and see what you just had to say.
All right. What are the answers, Alan?
Well, you know, I think those comments are well taken. I think mm-hmm. represent the views of a growing number of Americans. And what they really get to is that, you know, I think poverty, wherever you find it, cities or suburbs, is a function of a wider inequality in America, and the fact that over the last 10 or 20 years, sort of shrinking segment of the American population has done very, very well, based on, you know, a number of factors, you know, education, but it's also, I think, you know, where power in America lies politically and economically. And really, the bottom half of the economic distribution has either stagnated or lost ground. And just to the, you know, to the point of our book, I think it's, you know, what's clear from the data that we're seeing and the stories that we're seeing as we go around the country is that no place is immune from those sort of macro forces. It's not something that's just going to affect the poorest neighborhoods and cities. It's something that you'll find in all types of communities. So if you, if you're concerned about poverty, you can't run away. You should do something about it. If you're not concerned about it, you also can't run away from it, because sooner or later, it's going to be on your doorstep. Hmm. So you ought to care about it, and you ought to care about what we do to help places that are struggling with its effects succeed as places, but also help those families succeed and really participate in the economy.
So let's, before we go back to phone calls, highlight at least one, and we'll move in others as we talk here, highly innovative individual who has made a difference.
Yeah, and that really is, as you mentioned, a big purpose of this book is you can get very frustrated, I think,
yes.
If you just train your sights on Washington and what is Washington doing or not doing about poverty or really any issue confronting the United States today, because we're just, it's partisan food fighting and nothing's really getting accomplished. But if you look instead to the local level, it's the case today, and I think it's always been the case, that the energy and the entrepreneurialism of the American people is evident outside the Beltway, a commitment to solving problems, innovating in the face of challenges. So just to take one example, we spent some time in Houston with an organization called Neighborhood Centers. It was one of the original settlement houses 100 years ago, helping new immigrants to the country at that time, at the end of the 19th, early 20th century, integrate and assimilate. But today it's serving all kinds of different communities demographically across the Houston metropolitan area, in the city, in the suburbs. It's sort of meeting these communities where they are, figuring out what their residents need, and tailoring programs and services to meet those needs and take advantage of what's really good about those communities and their residents, help them connect to skills, to transportation, to support services like nutrition and financial services. They're running charter schools. For us, it's an example of the kind of scale and sophistication that we need with poverty alleviation. So we're not leaving sort of every tub on its own bottom and not relying only on small community-based organizations to try to wage these battles, but we're really putting our resources and our big bets behind organizations that can do more than one thing in more than one place at the same time. For us, that's really one of the keys for confronting not just suburban poverty, but also urban poverty and rural poverty in America.
Josiah from Chippewa Falls is next. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask what criteria you use to define poverty in the book. I know you said maybe one in three Americans is in poverty, so I was wondering about like the income levels and how you would define that.
Yeah, that's a great question and probably a good place for me to have begun. In the book, we are actually looking, and when we hear about where one-third of poor Americans living in the suburbs, that's actually based on the federal definition of the poverty line, which when you tell it to most people, I think they find it to be rather low. It represents about today about $22,000 for a family of four, a little under $20,000 for a family of three. So you're not living all that great, even if you have an income slightly above the poverty line. So from time to time, we also look at folks who are living under twice the poverty line, what we call poor or near poor, and that's where you find about one-third of Americans today. And in fact, if you look at that kind of poor and near poor population, that population is even more suburbanized, if you will, than the population below the poverty line. But either way, in big metropolitan areas, you'd find a majority of poor or near poor people today living outside big cities versus inside.
Thanks so much for the call. Bill in River Falls. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show, great topic. I'd like to add a little different perspective. I would like to state that suburbs are in permanent decline, and that's the big picture. The leading housing expert, Robert Shiller, said that last year after the U.S. Census Bureau said that suburbs are declining. And I would like to suggest that the real driving force is Gen Y. Gen Y is not going to move to the suburbs, and that's why they are declining in population. That's why the poor are moving into suburbs, is because housing is going to continue to decline in terms of value and worth. And so I think when you look at this generationally and why they're not moving to the suburbs, they are moving into the cities with light rail and trains. I live two blocks from the third most prosperous suburban county in Wisconsin, St. Croix County, and it grew zero in the last year. So this is happening in Wisconsin, but suburbs are in permanent decline. And only poor people will live in suburbs. And I'm going to predict that housing values in suburbs will decline 30% between now and 2020.
Mm, thank you, Bill, for the call. Do you share that?
Well, the short answer is no, but it's the longer answer is, you know, I think as with a lot of other things, it depends. And I do believe there probably are a subset of suburban communities in America today that are facing a very, very uncertain future coming out of the housing market decline and facing some of these new demographic shifts to which the caller was referring. What seems to be, I think like a lot of generations, Gen Y is rejecting what their parents chose, which was suburbia, and you know, training their sights more on urban communities. So I think, you know, for a subset of suburbia, it is a very uncertain future and possibly one of decline. But for every one of those communities, there are suburbs that are still, blowing up, doing quite well. What's interesting about those suburbs, and here in the Washington, D.C. region, I'm thinking about a lot of northern Virginia and parts of Maryland, like Montgomery County, just outside of Washington, D.C., those places are doing well as suburbs because, in a way, they're urbanizing, and they're becoming more like their city counterparts when it comes to planning and design and transportation options and housing options. So I think that's the future for a lot of suburbs that will allow them to continue to grow. The danger is that we'll have suburbs like that, and then suburbs on the other side of the region where all the poor people go. And in doing that, they will be separated and isolated from the economic opportunities that are accruing to the growing places with the rising incomes and the good jobs and the good schools. So in a way, you know, I think we're trying to sound the alarm that if we're not serious about putting in place the kinds of services, the kinds of supports, the kinds of connections, and thinking in a different way about how we build our metropolitan areas, we stand to repeat the mistakes that we've made over 30 or 40 years with inner city communities. They're just going to replicate themselves in some of our suburbs today. And the final thing I'd say is for the caller, anybody who's interested in that viewpoint, there is a new book out by an author called Leigh Gallagher. It's called The End of Suburbs. And I think it goes into, and I think it plays out the argument the caller was making in an interesting way. And I think it's a good companion volume to look at to ours as well.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Bill, and thanks for the recommendation. Very generous of you, Alan. I want to go back to, and it's not just the Contra Costa country, but all of the people who moved to suburban areas in the 2000s and found that they could, you know, get their houses, and they thought that was their big investment, and they're going to sell them for more than they were worth, and then people went under, people lost their jobs, the housing thing burst. Where are all those people living now? If they've stayed in the suburban areas, what's their housing situation?
Yeah, I think many of them probably are still in suburban communities, in, you know, like the Contra Costa examples in inland California, but you'd also find similar communities outside of Phoenix and outside of Las Vegas, in a lot of central and southern Florida, the places that had the most rapid building, the largest run-up in housing prices, the most speculation and the most subprime mortgage activity through the first half of the 2000s. And these are the places where the bottom really fell out. So I think you've got folks who have lost jobs and incomes, and maybe they've just, you know, they've converted from being homeowners in these communities to being renters in these communities or being homeless in these communities. I think the housing situation that these families face is a reflection of what is a larger sort of economic uncertainty facing these places and their residents that have really kind of lost their reason for being in the wake of the housing crisis, are trying to find it again. But in many ways, if we're going to succeed as a nation with our economy, and we're going to succeed as regional economies, we can't bet on housing as salvation alone. Our economies have to be more diversified. They have to focus on making things and selling things to the rest of the world rather than just consumption and housing alone. So finding, you know, these communities finding their footing again, that might be a very, very long process and might, you know, again, make for a pretty uncertain near-term future for the families most affected by the foreclosure crisis.
Alex calling from Chicago. Hi, Alex.
Hi. Thank you, Kathleen, for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a great show. I have a quick observation. I left the suburbs 20 years ago and went to New York City, lived there for 20 years, and then I returned to the same suburb I grew up in. And my mom had since moved out of that suburb, and I was just talking to her on the phone the other day saying, like, you know, I drove through our old neighborhood, and it is really, really different. I mean, I grew up, there was like, everyone had a car or two. Nowadays, the housing stock, it's really worn down. There are like four or five, six cars in the driveways. And I think that's a reflection of people, you know, many people living in a house.
Yes.
And everyone having a different job and everyone having a different schedule. And it has really transformed the whole suburban world that I am used to growing up. And I grew up in the 60s. So I was just wondering, is this it feels really crowded, much more so than when I was little. Is that another element of this changing suburban landscape?
Thanks for your call and your observation, Alex. Yeah, I think you do find that in a lot of the older suburbs that ring a lot of our big central cities in America, and it could be a number of different things going on there. You know, we see, especially in areas of the country that have a lot of immigration, that immigration is now skipping cities. It used to start in cities, right? And then when the immigrants got a real foothold, would move out to suburban communities. Now it's just skipping the cities altogether, landing in suburbs first because that's where the affordable housing opportunities are. That's where the social networks are. There might be better entrepreneurship opportunities for new immigrant populations there. But it does change the look and the feel of these communities. It creates tension in some of these communities. But the observation about the housing, you know, getting older and looking, you know, worn down, I mean, this is the cycle of cities and communities in America that's now found its way into suburbs, right? There's so many city neighborhoods that underwent decline and disinvestment in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s for a whole range of different reasons. And now, you know, 50 years later, their number is coming due and people are saying, oh, you know, these places have really great bones and they're proximate to jobs. And so maybe we'll put some money in. And this is what we hear about as gentrification in America, the repopularization of these neighborhoods. It's just that cycle is now, the first part of that cycle is now finding its way to a lot of these suburban communities that were built in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. The housing's getting worn down, getting disinvested. I just think it would be a shame if those communities were put through the same sort of 40 or 50 year cycle in between that a lot of our inner cities suffered, and they didn't get access to investment, and they didn't get economic diversification and, you know, connection to jobs through transportation. I don't think we want to put a couple of generations through what our inner cities went through, and that's why we need to pay attention to the changes going on in suburban America.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about jobs, because the focus certainly, when we look at people who have been downsized, has been on manufacturing jobs, particularly in the Midwest, that have gone overseas, but they're people in the city is what we think about. So the plan has been to get some manufacturing jobs to move back or to come up with a different kind of economy. When we think about suburban jobs, are we thinking about a complete lack of jobs, or have you been able to highlight some suburban communities that have grown certain kinds of jobs that have kept people able to maybe even walk to work and find new employment when they lost their jobs in the city?
Yeah, and I think you do find stories of, you know, decline, but also recovery when you look at suburban communities. And as you and I think most of your listeners are aware, you know, manufacturing, again, 50 years ago was an urban industry. Now it's pretty much a wholly suburban industry. Again, where I'm from in New England, at the turn of the 20th century, you know, manufacturing was a kind of dirty urban thing. It went on in, you know, our older cities like Worcester and Lawrence and Lowell. But now, today, you know, and over the last generation or so, manufacturing is completely suburban. It's in, you know, it's in office parks and industrial parks that are off the freeway. So the decline of that industry that New England and the Midwest have suffered over the last 30 or 40 years has affected suburban communities and families much more so, much more so than urban families. Hmm. So the places that seem to be making some headway in you know, in diversifying and recovering from that decline, I'd say they have a couple of things going for them. One is skills, and they are building on assets like universities and you know, growing the educational attainment of their populations, because that's really what, more than anything else, employers look for now when they're thinking about where they're going to locate or where they're going to expand, is do they have access to a talented labor pool. It doesn't really matter anymore if you're on a river like it used to be. It's really about, did the people in this place have the skills that they need to be productive and to keep our company competitive? And I think the other thing they have is connections. And sometimes they're close to another city that's doing very well, but they're just, they're building the kind of infrastructure, and they're building the kind of communities that, that keep themselves connected through transportation, through housing, through land use policy. So the communities aren't separated and segregated from one another, but so that people, no matter where they are in the metropolitan area, can find their way to jobs quickly, so that employers can find workers quickly, and so that those places can not only connect to themselves, but connect out to the rest of the world, markets elsewhere in the United States and markets abroad. So skills and connections, I think, are what's essential for recovery and diversification of not just suburban economies, but, right, but metropolitan economies altogether.
Mm. Thanks, Alex. Thanks for listening and for calling. We'll continue with our phone calls. We're speaking this hour about suburban poverty. Ellen Berube is co-author of Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. He and his co-author traveled all over the United States and found, lo and behold, it was a surprise to them, too, that there is a great deal of poverty in suburbs in this country. One-third of all Americans poor or nearly poor. One in three of those Americans happen to be living not in cities, but in the suburbs. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, should you want to leave messages there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at this time, we explore Working Mothers Magazine's annual report of the best companies to hourly employees. We spent so much time talking about how hard things have been for so many workers. We're going to look at where it's good. We'll look at these companies and find out what they're doing to make sure that their employees have stability, predictability, they have benefits to succeed in their job without disrupting their families, and it's not hurting the bottom line. And why is that the case? Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Back to phone calls. Jim is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hey, I wanted to add a perspective to what you're talking about when it comes to poverty. My 78-year-old dad retired, I don't know, 15 years ago or something, and for a while he paid taxes on his retirement income, and then he got to a point where he no longer had to pay any taxes, and he fell beneath that poverty level. And to be honest with you, it kind of became sort of a joke, because this 78-year-old father of mine was born in 1934 in New York in Hungary, and when he came, before he came to America, I mean, they were kicked out by the Russians, shipped into Germany where, you know, if you were under 18, you got a pound of meat a week, and if you were over 18, you got a half a pound of meat a week. And he'd go home after school, look in the cupboards, and his mother would say, you know, there's no food, son. There wasn't that yesterday. There isn't today. And she would tell him just go to bed, and you'll forget that you're hungry. And he would tell me that, hey, I'd go lay down, go to sleep, and I'd forget I was hungry till I woke up in the morning. So when he hit that poverty level here in America with a car in his driveway, a roof over his head, and food in the refrigerator, I got to be honest with you, all he could do is kind of laugh. That's all. I take your comments off the air. Thanks.
I'm not entirely sure where you're going with that, but Alan, maybe you have a better idea.
Well, I do. I think it is. It's a debate, and not the first time that I've encountered it about what does it really mean to be poor today? Because poor people today are way better off than poor people 80 years ago, or poor
right.
people in Africa. You know, poor. If you look at it from those vantage points, being poor in America is a pretty good deal. And sure, if that's your basis for evaluation and comparison, and certainly somebody like the caller's dad, who's seen it from both sides, probably does feel very lucky. And I think that's great. It's about what, as a very wealthy society, the wealthiest in the world, we are willing to accept and tolerate in terms of the economic plight of our disadvantaged populations. And people do go to bed hungry in America today. The statistics show it. People do miss economic opportunities because of a lack of transportation or child care and get stuck in dead-end jobs that inhibit the educational progress of their kids. I think, even at $20,000 a year, families face a lot of missed opportunities and injustices in our society that if we commit a modest amount of resources and a little bit of focus, we don't have to tolerate. And I think if we do tolerate them, that's a reflection on us, and I don't think it reflects very well on us. It doesn't really have anything to do with what other parts of the world choose to spend or don't choose to spend on poverty or what they consider to be poor.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really about our choices and our values, and more than anything else about the next generation and what sorts of opportunities we're going to give them.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't reject what the caller is saying, but I do think it is a question of the here and the now, and
right.
what we're gonna be prepared to do about that.
Yeah, I mean, everybody should have food. His dad shouldn't have had to go to bed. Go to bed, and you'll be all right. So you won't think about it. Well, sometimes you can't sleep because you're pretty hungry. I mean, that's horrible. It's horrible.
Yeah, and I think that means a very different thing when you're 78 years old than it does when you're
right.
10 years old,
I'm
and
sure.
you're trying to learn during the school day. You can't be hungry. You can't not have eyeglasses and see the
mm-hmm.
see the blackboard. There are just so many things that about poverty that inhibit the ability of families and their kids to make progress in America today.
Well, and in some ways too, you want all of us to be able to figure this out, don't you, Alan? Because if people want to work, and most people work really hard in this country and want to work, and it helps define your life and who you are, that we ought to be able to find a way so that people can have jobs and buy food and get a house and all of those things that at times in our history we've been able to figure out. And you also look at it, and it's hard not to, in the context of a really huge disparity between those who have, 10 houses and all the food that they want to have, and try to balance that with people who are homeless. It's just hard to take it all in and to figure out the way forward and what's fair.
Yeah, it reminds me of a saying I saw on a bumper sticker once, which was, everybody gets one house before anybody gets two.
That's a good one.
And look, I don't think that's not necessarily reflective of the kind of capitalist society that we are.
Right.
But I think that the danger lies not in the existence of poverty in this country or anywhere. I think it's probably going to be the case that we'll always have some level of poverty. I think it's too high right now. It doesn't have to be this high. But the broader danger is that people get stuck there, and we don't have decent social and economic mobility in America. And the whole premise of America is that, right, that anybody can make it, and it doesn't really matter where you start. If you put the hard work in, if you're dedicated,
yes.
you too can be rich.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that's not true, but the statistics show very clearly it is less true than it used to be. We are a more socially hidebound society than even a lot of old Europe, what we think of as these caste ridden societies. It's harder for people today to make progress up the economic ladder in America than it used to be or in a lot of other parts of the world. And I do think, you know, tolerating poverty and tolerating lack of access to jobs and to good schools for a significant portion of our population in metropolitan areas, including in suburbs, is part of what is going into that trend of decreasing social mobility.
Pat in Brookfield, hi.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
I think what I take away from this conversation, even last hour and this hour, is the need for us to be able to separate, you know, the emotional argument from a logical conversation. And, you know, what I mean by that, emotionally, I hear a lot of people call up and they say, they'll make the argument that, you know, because we want to have a conversation about somehow reforming the SNAP program or other means of public assistance, well, all of a sudden those people are bad and evil, and we want to take away this, that, and the other thing. Then I hear, you know, the other side, which is, you know, poor people are eating crab and this, that, and the other thing, which also isn't true. But, you know, living in Milwaukee, I've seen over the past year and a half, there was a big Journal Watchdog series on child care fraud. There was just a huge one on the SNAP program and all the fraud in that as well. So I think we need to get away with the callers calling up either on one side or the other and saying there's nothing we can do. We need to give out free handouts or whatever you want to call it to everybody. And you can't ever look at these programs. And then the other people that need to be discredited are also the people that say there's no poor people out there. They're the fault, you know, why we're in a huge debt and that type of thing. So, and when I've been listening to the last 2 hours, I hear either or. It's one or the other. There's nothing ever in the middle, and I think that's the main problem today is we can't have a logical discussion without emotion and partisan politics getting involved.
What do you say to that, Alan?
Well, I mean, I hope I've tried to present, you know, a kind of nonpartisan and evidence-based point of view about where poverty is in America and who it's affecting and how we need to sort of think about it differently, no matter what your views are on any given program or the level of fraud and error in the food stamp program or the child care program. I think it's always been the case that at the margins there are people who are taking advantage of these programs, but it is the margin. It's not how these resources are, you know, finding their way to most families who really are in need of them, whether they live in cities or in suburbs. And in fact, you know, again, from the vantage point of suburban poverty, the issue that we identify most often is that people are eligible for these things and they're not getting access to them because they don't have those services near their communities, because they don't, they're not aware of these programs, they don't have a social network that can connect them to that. They have to, you know, get on a bus all day to go down to the downtown welfare office to sign up for this stuff every 3 months. And again, so I think I don't take an either or view on this stuff about whether it's fraud ridden or whether, you know, poor people don't deserve this stuff. I think this stuff, if you read the evaluations, gets to the families who deserve it and need it. It helps kids do better in school. It helps families put food on the table or gain access to jobs through child care. I think most of what we do for the poor in America works pretty well. I think, in general, we don't do enough of it for enough people. Doesn't mean that we can't always do better in the delivery and weed out the bad actors. But I think to take a dim view only of our anti-poverty programs and not all the other things that the government does for middle and upper income people that, you know, are also riddled with fraud and error,
yeah,
is a kind of narrow view.
And our purpose in doing these kinds of shows is, of course, there's something at play that makes this a controversial issue. We did food stamps the last hour that makes it controversial now when it hasn't been controversial since 1973. And there's something that we need to look at when we determine that a lot of people are in poverty in the suburbs. I mean, that we're just looking at issues that have changed the fabric of America in some ways, and they're worth having conversations about. But I understand Pat's points that things have become highly political on just about everything. When we should be looking at, you know, what it's like to be a human being in America in this year and how it's hard for people. And should it be that hard? And what can we do to make people's lives a little bit easier and thus more meaningful? I think those are good conversations to have, you know, and that's what you were doing in your book. And
yeah, and I think, you know, the conclusion to our book is that poverty is a hardship. It doesn't matter whether you're in a city or in a suburb right. or in a rural area. These families are straining to put enough food on the table, to keep their lights on, to mm-hmm. find a decent paying job. And it doesn't matter if you're in Pittsburgh, California, or you're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Right.
And so it means approaching the issue, yeah. and I think in a very different way than we did 40 or 50
years. Thank you, Ellen. Thanks so much. Great conversation. Thanks for looking at the issue. Ellen Berube, the book is Confronting Suburban Poverty in America, published by Brookings. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.